Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. When people learn that author Jim Krestovic grew up on an Indian reservation, the follow-up question is usually, are you an Indian? Jim's memoir, Navajo Wear Nikes, is, he writes, an effort to answer that question the way his Navajo friends would, with stories. Jim Krestovic, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Jim, the res town that you grew up in, Ganado, Arizona, is not far from the New Mexico border. And I know from reading your book that you drove from Albuquerque to Ganado a lot of times. So just to give people an idea where Ganado is, how would you drive there from Albuquerque?
Well, you would just take Route 40 right out of Albuquerque, go west, Route 66, right, Route 40, into Gallup. From Gallup, go to Winder Rock on 264. From Winder Rock, St. Michael's, and then off you go to Ganado. It's this little valley in Arizona there. It's a two-mile stretch of civilization in a grassy kind of desert valley. It's split by a school campus and a hospital campus. And you can see out beautiful mesas. There's corn terraces there. People farm corn, melons, beautiful wash flowing through. In a good deal of water.
So you're very young when you come there, and the adjustment that you need to make to fit in there. I think you're starting the second grade or something. And I understand that you've selected a reading for us from your book that talks about that. Could you read that for us?
Oh sure, yeah. Yeah, this is just this is from the first story that's in the book. Story is called White Apple, and this is a quick excerpt from my first day walking into the school. And you know, everybody who goes to school, a new school first day, you're really nervous, you know. And so I was already kind of nervous. My mom walked me to the classroom, and I was there with the teacher. She was really nice, you know, and I thought, oh, this will go well. And I was standing, and she introduced me to the kids, and they all turned around. And I had already made friends with a few Navajo kids before school started, but here these kids are looking at me, and they call me this name, and they just seem like strangers to me.
Yeah, how do you pronounce that name?
The name is Bilagana.
Bilagana.
Bilagana, yeah. So mm-hmm. that's kind of where it starts. So, I'll start the excerpt here. A slim student with spiked black hair laughed and pointed at me with his lips like Ferlin had done. Bilagana, he said. Some students near spike hair giggled. A chubby girl sitting in front of my desk whispered the word, Bilagana. I stepped back and gripped my He-Man backpack tight against my shoulders. These kids were not like Ferlin, Shandy, or Lester Chasing Hawk. These were Indians. A dark-haired tribe in jeans and Nikes that stowed tomahawks in their backpacks among their three-ring binders. They were savages that scalped with flint knives, burned houses, buried cowboys to the neck, and laughed while colonies of ants gnawed away their swollen tongues like ripe plums beneath the desert sun. Mom had tricked me. This is where the 2,000-mile western trail across the interstates of the United States had led. This is where my mom's Indian dream ended, in an ambush. Another group of Indians near the window laughed, and one pointed at me with his lips like he was casting a curse. I wanted to run home, to catch a 100-degree fever, to vomit, anything, but the Indians watched me, and their skins became redder, and their eyes and teeth became whiter than my skin could ever be. Go on, Jimmy, Mom said, poking me toward my seat. I'll see you after school. Just walk to the hospital, and I'll meet you there. I nodded and kept my hands from reaching for her while my eyes filmed over and my throat grew a lump. Don't cry, I told myself. Don't show them fear. Miss Quahy led me to my seat, where I began to cry as soon as I heard a group of girls giggling like the chickadees Ferlin and I had watched and followed in the tamarisk thicket just 3 days ago. All I wanted was for my skin to turn brown or fall off.
So your mom's a nurse, and she gets this opportunity then to work in a hospital in Ganado, right? And that's that's sort of the origin of the journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was hired by this hospital in Ganado. Yeah.
And you know, one of the things I really love about the passage you read is how you sort of depersonalize the, quote, Indians in your class and distinguish them from the Navajo friends you'd already made, from from the from Ferlin and Lester, who are friends of yours, but these are, quote, Indians in the class. And that seems to be sort of what racism is all about, right? You depersonalize and you're scared. And so you make this generalization as a kid.
Yeah. Total fear reaction. Yeah, totally. I mean, it's a lot easier to deal with something that's not human or has emotions like you do, so you can kind of, deal with the problem. But, they're ultimately not the problem. Your fear is the problem.
Yeah. But what ends up happening, it seems like, Jim, is that you kind of have to fight your way into acceptance with this group of kids. And the fights that you have, they don't seem like the fights that I had when I was in the second and third grade. I mean, you guys are seriously trying to hurt each other.
Yeah.
We would just wrestle, and when someone would get down, then we'd walk away. You guys didn't do that.
Oh, no. See, what was really the goal was, I look back at it, and I was like, the goal was to, shame somebody, but not, just pin them down, but it was, slam him down, then punch him and rub sand in his eye or something, and it's then get up and then kick him in the face or something. But yeah, it was never so bad that we went to the nurse for a fight. But we'd have bruises on the face or the arms, and our sides and stuff. Not just me, but friends of mine who got in fights over little things. You stepped on my G.I. Joe and punch him in the face.
That's one of the things I wanted to ask you. I mean, the fighting was common, not just with you and other Navajos, but just among the people in the class, I take it.
Oh, yeah. But it was weird. It's people would throw punches at each other, and then, afterward, they just laugh about it. It wasn't,
I see.
A dark storm was going on in their head, and they were like psychopath. But it was like, I punched you in the face. Ha, ha, ha. Oh, that was great. It was like a joyful kind of...
Really?
Violence. Yeah.
Because it seems like you kind of depict the reservation life in general as a violent place.
I think objectively it's pretty violent still. I mean, there's still, if you read the police blotter, say Page, Arizona, or some southwestern town that's off the res, and then read the police blotter in the Navajo Times, there's a lot more violence in that police blotter, So even though there's a laughter in the violence, it's still violent. I mean, I've never seen the kind of violence I saw when I was a teenager and a kid elsewhere, what I saw on the res. Yeah.
I see. So, well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're very pleased to have the author of Navajos Wear Nikes, Jim Christofik. Jim is a blue-eyed, brown-haired kid who starts the second grade in a res town, and he's answering the question, are you an Indian, in this book. And one aspect of the culture that really surprised me that you talk about in the book is that the kids, and I'm not sure if it's just the boys or the boys and the girls, they sort of have an L.A.-style street gang type of dress. I would never have guessed that would be the style of dress that was adopted.
Yeah, what people have told me, people who are older than me and lived on the res longer than me, people in their 70s or their 80s, and I've talked with them about, some of them are white people who were missionary kids. Some of them were, graduates of Ganado Mission High School, and they went off the res and, came back and became politicians. I was talking with the former Navajo Nation president last summer about it, and they always had little rough and tough gangs who would run around, try to dress like James Dean, that sort of thing. But in the 90s, especially in the early 90s, that you started to have a gang phenomena kind of growing up on the res, building up. And the way it was explained to me when I was in middle school, when there was more information about it, it was like Chicano or Latino gangs based in L.A. would come out to the res and recruit people there. That was now this is folklore, though. I mean, I this might be wrong. I don't know. I've never really in-depth researched whether this is true or not. But that was always the story. story we heard growing up. It's like, oh, these guys are coming in from L.A. or Vegas. Dude, they're from Albuquerque. He's a gangbanger. You know, we'd hear things like that. Oh, we should join them. Oh, screw them. I'm not joining them. You know, stuff like that. But, yeah, it was like it was a way to emulate, you know, gangster rap, really popular.
So, I didn't have the impression. I thought it was just the dress. But you're saying there's actual gangs or you've been told that there was infiltration by gangs onto the Res.
Well, when I was in fourth grade, that's when a boy was killed in Ganado, and it was it ended up that it was like related to I won't say gang activity, but it's like the sort of violence that gangs do to each other. You know, group up, get in a fight, it escalates. Someone pulls a knife, sticks it in someone. Oh shoot! I can't believe I just did that, and everyone runs away.
I see.
And that's what happened. In one of the stories in the book was the next day, you know, we had to go to school, and this kid, he didn't go to school there. He was older than us. I can't remember if he was a high school kid or a middle school kid, but he had died on our basketball court is what we were told, and we had to go out there and see. I remember seeing a little bit of his chalk outline still there, you know. And you know, these are child memories, so maybe it wasn't there, but we all believed it was there, you know, and it was just always on our mind after that. And there wasn't really any, at least when I was living there in Ganado, there wasn't anything like that again for years and years, but it was a very haunting thing. Like, everybody was just so curious, though. They wanted to go out and see if they could, like, you know, find some change that fell out of his pocket, some kind of like souvenir or something. You know, it was people almost didn't know what to do with it. You know, it was this strange thing that just kind of landed on our basketball court, and yeah, we were just so curious, we didn't know what to do.
So another aspect of your acceptance is your teacher suggests that you start helping the students. Your fellow students with their classwork, and it wasn't clear to me whether schoolwork just came really easy to you, which you say you found it pretty easy, or whether the school itself wasn't that challenging.
I came from a grade school in Pittsburgh, which was I look back at it now and I'm like, yeah, that was pretty challenging stuff. So I already had a jump ahead of the kids who were being schooled there, and it turned out that schoolwork in general is pretty easy for me. Like I can do it, you know, with some strength. And later, when I was in high school and in college and in graduate school, I found out, you know, I'm a pretty good student. I don't consider anything else, but I'm a pretty good student. And so she was asking me, oh, you know, you should help them, and you know, it's like helping my enemies. Why would I help my enemies? You know, and it's funny because I did not remember that at all. But that teacher, I knew her son later. Quahi was her name, and she said at a Boy Scout meeting one night. This was, you know, years later, and I'm friends with all these crazy Navajo kids running around during a Boy Scout meeting. You know, just playing tag outside or, like, you know, tracking animals on the wash on the weekend and stuff. We were at this meeting, and she said, hey, James, do you remember when you were in second grade in my class? I asked you to help those kids. I was like, yeah, I remember that. That's kind of how I started fitting in, because they learned that they could get their work done fast by having me help them, you know. And she said, I remember when I asked you to do that, and I said, you should help them. And you got all angry, and you said, it's not my fault. They're stupid, and you just didn't talk to anybody for days, you know, and I remember that, and I remembered, I went, oh, yeah, I did do that, didn't I? But at that point, by the time I was in fifth, sixth grade, you know, like, that was, like, a totally different person. Like, I'd even forgotten it, but until she reminded me.
So how would you evaluate the school systems in general on the Res?
The school system, I don't even want to say the system, sometimes there are people who teach on the Res who have low expectations, and it's not even from malice sometimes, you know, and I'm saying sometimes because I don't know the percentage, but I do know it's tough because a lot of people who teach on the Res aren't permanent. They don't stay a long time. There are some who do stay a really long time, who are really dedicated. I had many teachers in Ganado and in Page, which is like a Res border town, that were there for decades, you know. But they were kind of that lone rock in the department, or one or two or three people, and they'd have people come in They can't handle the isolation. They don't like that there's no stoplights. Where's the shopping mall? 2 hours away? No, you know, and they don't stay. Maybe they can't adapt to the res lifestyle. Maybe they get uncomfortable, and so they don't stay. And then, you know, it's a problem too, because, you know, 60% of people who are Navajo, who are like members of the tribe, this is the statistic I got from the tribe itself, was that, you know, 60% of them, they don't live on the reservation. You know, they have to make living in towns like Albuquerque or Santa Fe, you know, Page, Farmington, Flagstaff, Phoenix. A lot of my friends who I graduated high school with are Navajo, or who graduated from Ganado same year as me, are living in the valley down in Phoenix right now, or Tucson.
Well, it sounds like there's not many opportunities. You know, if you have to drive 2 hours to go shopping, it doesn't sound like there's very many opportunities for work after high school. Let me just mention that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're talking today with author Jim Krzysztofik, who wrote the book Navajos Wear Nikes. And really, we haven't talked yet about, I think, the thing that really draws you to the Navajo people and to the Navajo life, and that's this idea of harmony and contemplation that you really grow to love. And I understand that you have a second reading that talks about that, and I wonder if you could read that for us.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So this is a passage from a story called Shadow Hunting. And that was a popular thing to do to prove how tough you were, you know, because almost everyone on the res believes in, like, skinwalkers, in witchcraft. And the idea is if you go out at night, you're not allowed to whistle. You go, now that whistle I just made, you know, if you're listening to this in your car or you're in the office listening to the radio, it's not real scary, but imagine you're on a mesa like I was in this passage, and you're out near Wood Springs and you're surrounded by junipers and a fire, and you can get up on a high point and you look out 40 miles and not see any lights, nothing but stars, and then whistling. So you can't do that. If you do that, you'll summon witches to you, you know. So all us kids were out there just goofing around, being idiots. And we had a big campfire, and we were just, you know, goofing around and punching each other and wrestling and stuff. And then, yeah, in the middle of all that, you have this contemplation, you know. And this is the passage here. Those who grew tired walked away from the fire, jogged in the cold, bent their backs to see the stars, rock star mica, thrown carelessly into the sky by coyotes so many ages ago after first man had hung the constellations. Some napped in their tents. Sterling Cornfield and I vowed to stay awake and keep watch, and Aaron joined us. I want to go out there sometime, Aaron said, pointing with his lips into the darkness beyond the fire. Where? I asked. The juniper log popped over the coals, and a terse constellation of sparks spun upward. Out there, into the wild, Aaron said. My family could drop me off in the middle of the summit or out in the forest somewhere. I'd just take a knife and a canteen. I'd come back a month or two later, or I wouldn't come back at all. I'd tell them not to look for me. Yeah, I said. The log popped again, and a spark landed in Sterling's hair. He brushed it away and nodded. The desire to wander out into the world was a Navajo virtue all of us around the fire shared. I'd have to do it when I'm about 21, Aaron said. You could die, I said. Doesn't matter, he said, shaking his head and smiling. Death takes you when it's ready. Death is a homecoming. There's nothing you can do about it. When it's your time, it's your time. Sterling nodded at this, stirred the coals with a juniper stick. Three of us sat until the sunrise bleached the blue bands of dawn across the eastern sky.
I love that reading, too. I love that selection. And one of the things that it really points out is this idea you pick up that Navajos are kind of one with the world and one with nature. They're not separate. They don't see the world as something they're going to manipulate, at least in this passage.
Yeah. And that's I was trying to explain that to someone a few days ago because they asked, you know, well, how come they don't just, you know, develop the reservation. I was thinking, well, because they know what's there. I mean, it's the land. It's not sun. You know, it's the mother, the earth mother, and it's okay. pay to drive 2 hours to shop for an hour to buy the stuff you need to put in your mouth and eat, and then drive back 2 hours. But you'll have that land there for your livestock to farm. There's not going to be any chemicals leaching into the mother's skin. There's not going to be any chemicals getting puked up into Father Sky's face. It's going to be there, and it's always going to be there forever, decades and decades after you die, after your grandchildren pass away, after your great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren pass away. That land's going to be there to take care of you. So you have to take care of it. It's a responsibility, you know. I went to a college out east when I left, and they call it stewardship, you know. But like, I don't know what that word really means. I don't ever consider myself to be a steward to the people I love. I mean, I just take care of them because I love them. And so you're supposed to love your mother and your father. They give you everything you have. I mean, everything that keeps us alive comes from that. And so that was kind of part of the Navajo philosophy, if you want to call it that. I won't call it religion, really, but it's like a way of life, you know?
Yeah,
and
when your friend talks about he doesn't care if he dies, and if he dies, that's just what's going to happen. There's this acceptance of the world, what the world has to offer you, that that Anglos, or certainly I, don't tend to view the world that way.
I often ask my stepdad about that, because it's weird. It's like a lot of Navajo people I've run into, who at least who I know, and I found out after reading a bit that historically, you know, like, looking at the world is ultimately a choice you make, and a lot of Navajo people I run into are Christian, you know. But they also practice their traditional ceremonies, you know. So someone could be LDS, like my stepfather was. He's a Church of Latter-day Saints. He's Mormon, but he also speaks Navajo and can help in a ceremony. He trained as a medicine man when he was young. He eventually left it because of some really weird stuff that happened, and I detail that in the book with his permission. But you can believe in a Christian God. You can believe in Allah, whatever, you know. You can believe in a God of the desert of the Israelites, but you can also hold your traditional values as important, because that's what kept the Navajo people, the Diné, alive for generations, you know, through wars with the Spanish, through wars with the Americans. I was reading a book just yesterday, a book called 1493, which is, it's like 1492, but it's, you know, a year later, and it talks about the effect of, the biological effect of the European civilization meeting the North American civilizations. And the author, I learned something. I can't believe this. I almost don't think it's true, and I'm gonna investigate this. But he said that 4 out of 5 people in America died by the time the Europeans had spread across the continent. You know, like 90% of the native people died. Most of them died of disease. You know,
yeah, I know it's a shockingly high percentage, yeah. But I don't know if...
Yeah, and the Navajo people, I mean, a lot of them lived. So it just, for me, it kind of like, well, that way of life must work. I mean, they survived quite a biological and economic military upheaval.
So one of the really interesting things that happens to you is when, after you get done with high school, you go back east to college.
Yeah.
And you no longer quite fit into the society you left.
I think a lot of people from the res want to get off the res as fast as freaking possible when they can. You know, they just want to leave, and I did, definitely. And I went back east because my family is from Western PA. You know, I want to kind of wanted to reconnect with my roots there. It was a really pretty school that I went to. It looked like something out of, you know, Dead Poets Society. You know, this beautiful, you know, limestone brick campus and everything. But yeah, when I was there, I noticed things that were really different from how I was thought things were supposed to go, you know, like, one thing I noticed in Pennsylvania, the weather always sucks. Always. It's always bad, unless you're at the beach. You know, so, like, if it's sunny out and the birds are singing, oh my God, it's so hot out. Can you believe how humid it is here, you know? Or it's raining. I remember it rained there, and I would, like, walk to class with no shoes on. I was like, oh my gosh, it's rain. Like, it rains 4 days a year where I left.
But one of the things in the book is that you're horrified by your fellow students' waste, the way they're throwing away food,
and
you're inclined just to try to eat everybody else's food before they throw it away.
Yeah. Oh, we'd go to the cafeteria, and people would just take food, and they'd try a bite, and it didn't agree with them. Oh, this hot dog's too dry. Go get a new hot dog. I'd see the hot dog sitting there. Usually there's a dog who's wandering around, a lot of res dogs. You can just give them the hot dog. But usually you eat the thing. And they wouldn't eat it, and they would just toss it away, and it was like, what? You know, I thought maybe I'm sitting near some really wasteful people. Okay, so I'd sit with some different people. Everybody would do that. And then a year later, I got a job in the cafeteria, kind of washing dishes, you know, taking the food, dumping it. And I think we dumped more food than people ate. And this was like, you know, a school that practiced stewardship of the environment. You know, they would talk about that. I'm thinking, you're taking from the earth, you're spitting it back in its face. I don't understand what this is, you know.
Yeah,
that was really jarring.
The other thing that really grabbed me was that you're always looking at nature. You're looking at the trees, you're looking at the birds, and your fellow students pay no attention to it.
Yeah, there was a time when a hawk swept in on a tree branch and killed a squirrel. Just impaled that squirrel, that close eye, you know, right there. And that's like a spectacular thing to see that. You know, I'd seen things like that when I was a river guide back in Arizona and when I was growing up. And so this hawk is like eating this squirrel. You can see this is what people would say. It's like, and I would sit there and I'd watch it. You know, to see this intense transference of life, of energy, of the flesh entering another creature and creating its flesh, and that's like that is what life is. You know, it's transference of this life force, this energy to create harmony. And if not enough hawks ate the squirrels would overpopulate and they all starve. If you know not enough squirrels are there for the hawks would starve. So it's this interdependence, this handshake that they're having, although death is involved. You know. And so I'd watch that and just remember those things that, you know, a friend's grandpa would tell me out at the sheep camp. And I thought it was fascinating. And people looked at me like I was a psycho, like I was serial killer in training, you know. And I was like, no, you know, and then they would, you know, go off to the cafeteria and, you know, eat a chunk of a dead animal and act like that was normal. I'm like, well, yeah, of course it's normal. Everyone eats something, I guess. But, you know, they had no problem doing that and then only eating half and throwing it away.
Jim, we're going to have to leave it there. Yeah. I really want to thank my guest today, Jim Christofik, so much. Enjoyed your book and recommend it to readers. The book is Navajo Wear Nikes. I'd also like to thank my engineer today, Roman Garcia. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this and other locally produced shows can be found at KUNM.org. Archives of my prior shows can be found at the Spitz Report at stephenspitz.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.